biography of Godel, his name is very familiar to us, but his history is very declouded to us. I still include myself today. Just today I was researching him, and it's fresh meat. We're talking about the Chazon Ish. His Bar Mitzvah took place in 1891 in Kosowa, White Russia. And at the young age of 13, he made a pledge that he would always engage in Torah Lishma. I assume you're familiar with the Mishnah Perkei Avos, that one who is makabel himself to learn Torah Lishma zochel dvarim harbe. And basically, you go through that entire Mishnah. You go through Memchas Dvarim, and you can see that every one of them was fulfilled with Chazon Ish. It was absolutely Torah Lishma. Another thing which I noticed is that you don't find Hasidim. I have no agenda here, but you don't find Hasidim were in Lithuania. The way it was marked for a level-headedness, no punctures of emotion, extreme poverty, and like the Mishnah says, always his heart will be careful about the poor people, Misham takes the Torah. And so much Torah came out of Lithuania. And not for naught, I mean, major names we're all familiar with. I mean, you could tell me technically the Chafetz Chaim is not from Lithuania, but we're talking about technically just over the border. I mean, that was more Lithuania than Poland, even though it was technically Poland. And Rav Chaim Leizer, the undisputed Gadol HaDor, the undisputed Gadol HaDor at the time of all the Gedolim, meaning Rav Chaim Brisker, the Or Sameach, Chafetz Chaim, all recognized Rav Chaim Leizer as the Gadol HaDor. Here also another irony, Rav Chaim Leizer had no surviving children. There is scarcely a yeshiva named after him, and therefore his name is known, but people know very little about him. We're talking about the Gadol HaDor in the time of the major, mega Gedolim. I'd like to rectify that a little bit, but that's not my subject. But I guess what I can say is that Rav Chaim Leizer was the first to see in the Chazon Ish the seeds of greatness. And he monitored his where he was heading. And also, as we know, the Torah was given on a low mountain. There was no fanfare, mountain range. That was basically Lithuania. When the Chazon Ish, for the next 40 years after his bar mitzvah, he's going to learn Torah Lishma, totally secluded. At the age of 3, he mastered the Aleph Beis and told his father he knows all of Shas. He knows all of Shas. He said, yeah, open Shas anywhere. There's one letter, not one letter there I won't be able to read. At a little 3, he had also a sense of humor. When he was 7 years old, his mother once noticed that he wasn't eating. And she said nothing, she placed food in front of him, he wasn't eating. He didn't want to embarrass his mother because he didn't have a spoon. That's incredible sensitivity for a 7-year-old. It would be pretty insensitive if a yeshiva bachur would do that. But that's the kind of refinement of a little boy. Basically, at the age of 10, he had exhausted his teachers, and his father became his rebbe. But due to his father's communal duties as the rabbi of the town, he basically secluded himself in Beis Medrash, and that's going to be indicative of the rest of his life. Remarkable how many Gedolim, particularly the Chazon Ish, never went to yeshiva, and basically learned all on his own, and then emerged to Gadol HaDor. He began correspondence with Chaim Brisker and Mitzvah Blazer, and he would sign his correspondence Ish Mikasowa. He's from the town of Kosowa. Ish means a man from Kosowa. Ish is an acronym for Avram Yeshaya. That was his name. All his life he did things anonymously, with anonymity. And so he signed his correspondence, Ish. He was the Ish, the person. It was his allusion to his name. When he was 26 years old in 1905, he came to Vilna. He was introduced to Chaim Leizer. Honestly, truly, how many of you know the name of Chaim Leizer? How many of you know more than just his name? It's a lot less than the first hand. Let me just give you a brief map of Chaim Leizer. Chaim Leizer, because of incredible intellect and genius, he rises right away up the ranks. He marries the granddaughter of Joseph Salanter, and he sends his grandfather-in-law to be a shtickle Torah, which is very impressive. And Rav Salanter responds, speaking of the Ish Hazeh, I know you know Torah, I want to know that you're an Ish, I want to show that you're a mensch. And of course he's an unbelievable mensch, Chaim Leizer. In 1915, Chaim Leizer, what happened was, in the beginning of World War I, Russia suffered major defeats at the hands of the Germans, and the Russians sought scapegoats. And the classic scapegoat, of course, is the Jews. So he was informed the next day they're going to arrest him and exile him to Siberia, and he wouldn't be the only one. He went to his brother-in-law's house, Reuven Dov Dessler, the father of Dessler. In other words, Chaim Moser was the uncle of Dessler. He went to his home in Hummel, Russia, where he was there for the next year. And then he fathered European Jewry, Russian Jewry, Galician Jewry, and Polish Jewry. He raised the money for them. They were exiled, hundreds of thousands. And aside from their physical situation, which was appalling, their spiritual situation was disastrous. No mikvaos, no shochtim. No sifrei Torah, no tashmishi kedusha. No shofar, no mezuzah, nothing. And he went and raised the money for them. He was a frail man of weak constitution. He had no organization, no people working for him. Went from door to door, he raised the money, and he took care of them. Then, in 1940, June 1940, based on the Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact, they divided already in 1900 all of Eastern Europe, and Russia took the Baltic states, including Lithuania. There was a small window which was ajar. Chaim Moser instructed all the yeshivos to come to Vilna, which meant traveling by rail on Shabbos. He instructed Mir, Baranovich, Kletsk, Radin, Chochmei Lublin, Lubavitch, Kamenets, Baranovich, all to come to Vilna. There were 2,500 extra yeshiva bachim that now came in these trains. Picture the following. Overnight, you come to your house, 30 unexpected guests. Some are old, some are young, some are babies. You have to prepare for them a place to sleep, a place to eat, and food, in time of war, when there is no food. And if you can somehow figure out how you can take care of 30 people, unexpected, now imagine it was 300. How would you tend to them all? Where would you find shelter for them? Now imagine 3,000. And single-handedly, Chaim Moser did it. He sent a telegram to his Talmud in America, Blazer Silver, a Rav in Cincinnati, and he sent him a telegram saying, you have to send us money to take care of the yeshiva students, and he gave him a name for the organization, the Vat Hatzalah, not to be confused with the ambulance corps. And Blazer Silver thought it would be best to send someone who would be considered objective, who could report about the poorly plight of yeshiva students that were refugees in Lithuania. In Cincinnati was a fellow by the name of Dr. Samuel Schmidt, who was a fellow who was not religious, albeit he was born in Kovno, he spoke Yiddish. He had a doctorate in chemical engineering from MIT, and he owned and published the only Jewish newspaper in Cincinnati called Every Friday. And he was a devotee of Rabbi Silver. And he asked him to go to Lithuania. World War II had already broken out, albeit he had not yet come to Lithuania. He travels. He comes to see the Chaim Moser. Now, Chaim Moser, I heard this from Rabbi Yitzchak Breidowitz, quoting his Rosh Hashiva, Rav Ruderman, the Neisrael Rosh Hashiva, said Rav Chaim Moser's house was like, picture the Grand Chess Master sitting at a table with 14 people, and he's playing 14 people simultaneously. That was Chaim Moser. He sat at the table in his home, and it was just shook a marketplace of people. Sitting at the table is a widow, an orphan, a Rosh Hashiva, a Shtadlin, a person who wants to know if he should hire someone. Someone wants to know how he can deal with the government. And each one is talking to him simultaneously as he's writing his chidushim. He's writing Achiezer. He's speaking on the phone. He's talking to his wife. In his basement is a telegraph station bringing up telegrams all the time from all over the world. The mail is delivered 3 times a day. If anyone thought that there's no way he could pay attention to him and everyone else at the same time, he'd repeat verbatim what the person just said. As he's writing chidushim, they're so deep, you get the plums, you get the depth, you get the curve, whatever it is, just trying to fathom them. A genius beyond a comprehension. So Samuel Schmidt comes to Chaim Moser. This is already 1940. All of European Jewry is on his back. He's suffering from terminal cancer, pain that's indescribable. And he says to him, Reb Shmuel, he says, Rabbi, if you knew who I was, you wouldn't call me Reb. He says, you could leave the serenity of America and security of a family and travel to war-torn Europe. Indeed, you are, Reb Shmuel, and he put his hand on his shoulder, writes Dr. Samuel Schmidt, at that moment there was a metamorphosis, an opiokus of a kind. I transformed from Samuel to Reb Shmuel. And that man became a religious Jew. That's the gadol, to put his hand on his shoulder, turn into Shmuel. And after Strip and all the documentation we have of the Shios and the Ferenia during the war, all thanks to this dispatch he sent back, this newspaper in America. When he left Europe, he said, he got a man of Chaim Moshe who wished to see him. He ran to see Reb Chaim Moshe. He said, may I ask you a favor? He said, Rabbi, I'll do anything for you. Can you please do me a favor and deliver this letter in America? Of course. He was sure the letter was addressed to Blazer, so he didn't even look. So he was on the boat. So the letter was addressed to Mrs. Schmidt. He wrote a letter to this woman for thanking her for enabling her husband to travel to war-torn Europe and leaving the serenity, the tranquility, and the harmony of America. That's the Gadol Hador, Chaim Moshe. At that time, a couple had come from Poland. And Chaim Moshe would receive people just as he did before, except he couldn't sit at a table. He was in such excruciating pain. He was being burned alive from the cancer, and he was lying in a bed in his living room. This couple came to him, and they said they were to be married the next day, and they didn't have parents. The parents were already murdered, and they had no one to walk them down the aisle. Would he give them a bracha? Chaim Moshe looked at the girl, and he asked her if she'd learned Taras Mishpacha, the laws of family purity. She looked down. Chaim Moshe understood that answer, and he said to her, my daughter, of course if your mother would be alive, if you had sisters, they would instruct you what to do. Come with me. He got out of the sick bed. The apartment was teeming with people. He walked over to the window and he looked out the window that had a modicum of privacy. For the next half hour, he thought of the Lord. The Gadol Hador taught this girl. As everything else riding on his shoulders, all the orphans, all the refugees, all the entire situation, then he collapsed back in bed. He asked his wife to attend their wedding, and he gave them a wedding present. That's what Chaim Moshe. So now the Chazon Ish travels. In 1905, to meet with Chaim Moshe for the first time. In one fell swoop, Chaim Moshe assessed the greatness of this young 26-year-old, and from then on he monitored his progress. By the time the Chazon Ish was already in his 20s, every reputable shadchan was after his taste, trying to get a piece of the action. And he didn't want, he wasn't looking for money, he wasn't looking for the daughter of a big, he just wanted to learn Torah Lishma. They read on the shidduch of a girl who had come from Constantine, which is pretty far away, the Russian-German border, and she seemed to be just the right one. And she had a textile shop, which Chazon Ish would go to every morning after davening. He'd go and he'd wish her good morning after davening, and he'd come at night to do the bookkeeping with her, to help out with the finances. With the outbreak of war, one of the Karelitzes of Rami Shai Karelitz, the Chazon Ish, they fled to Stupayitz. But once again, she opened a textile shop, and it was very popular. And the Chazon Ish then spent a lot of time there to make sure that his wife shouldn't make anything, have a mistake with all the people there. And he himself personally measured the garments that were being sold so that neither Jew nor non-Jew should get an incorrect amount. He then takes refuge in Minsk. There's uprootings, food shortages, hardships, and nothing affects his studies. One relative said, those were the good days for the Chazon Ish. No one knew who he was. He was able to learn, with all this balagan going on, no one knew who he was. He had to learn with anonymity. In 1920, the Chazon Ish and his wife came to Vilna. His two very illustrious brothers, Rav Moshe and Rav Meir Karelitz, and his illustrious brother-in-law, Rav Shmuel Greinemann, received him there. But everyone else didn't understand what's the big deal about this poor couple. You have to realize, Talmid HaChamim and Vilna were a dime a dozen. They didn't realize this is a person far, far greater than anyone they'd ever seen before. Chazon Ish had a great desire to publish a svarim called the Chazon Ish, done anonymously. His name is not found anywhere there. And he said that every time the sefer came off the press, he felt like a couple walking their child down to the chuppah. Once there was an assemblage in Chaim Moshe's house, and Chafetz Chaim addressed it. Now, Chafetz Chaim was significantly, he was the senior of Chaim Moshe. And all matters of significance to the Chafetz Chaim deferred to Chaim Moshe. If something was truly important, he would travel that grueling trek from Radin, which is in Poland, to Vilna, Lithuania, to consult with Chaim Moshe. Interesting story that after World War I, Chaim Moshe was so involved in trying to rehabilitate the Jewry, which had been devastated. Who lost World War I? Well, the answer is everyone. I mean, the French also lost. They lost 1 million men. They were blood red. They were blood white. And the Americans, and the Canadians, and the Austrians, and the Germans, and the Turks, and the Russians, everyone lost. But the greatest loser were the Jews. The Russians took over a city, they burned the Jewish home. The Germans took over, they burned the Jews. Everybody's burning the Jews. There's nothing left. And Roger then had to rehabilitate Jewry. And the Chafetz Chaim had this plan that those that were in the Russian army, or the Lithuanian army, and the Polish army, they would station them from city to city, and they would compel the people of the city to feed the soldiers. They'd shove the soldiers on, you just feed them. And the Chafetz Chaim had the idea we should establish in any city with a large Jewish population what he called kosher kessel, kosher pot. We should have a kosher kitchen going so that if soldiers come, we can get some Jewish food in the gut of soldiers, which otherwise would never have an opportunity to eat kosher food. He felt it was such an important project, he felt he needed to do something like this in such great proportions. We need the approval of Gadol HaDor of Chaim Lozer. He made that long grueling trek to Vilna. Chaim Lozer said, that's a wonderful idea. But now with the priorities of trying to reestablish the Ketanos and the Gedolos, we can't allocate money for this. Chafetz Chaim had a way of winning an argument. He said, Ayisho America, he began to daven out loud. He said, what's going to be after 120? They'll call you a governor and say, Yisro America. He knew about the plight of these soldiers. They didn't do anything to help them out. And I said, what could I do? I'm already a man in my 80s. I made that trek to Vilna. By the way, 80s is a fluke. It's a freak. Each and everyone in this room will live to 120, but deep into your 80s. In those days, the average age was in the low 40s. So someone to live in their 80s was like someone today being 230. But that's me, he had long days. So he told Chaim Lozer that, what's going to be? So he asked me, why didn't I do anything for the soldiers? I said, what could I do? I made that trip to Vilna to speak to Chaim Lozer, the Gadol HaDor, but he told me it wasn't important enough. So Chaim Lozer knew when he was bested, in that moment, Kosher Kessel was born. Kosher Kessel was launched. So there's an assembly in Chaim Lozer's house, and the Chafetz Chaim is addressing all the Talmidim in the room, and in the room is also the Chazon Ish. Chazon Ish, who has always done everything that he could to remain anonymous from everyone. And said the Chafetz Chaim, right now, our generation is suffering, losing spirituality, and now everyone must cast aside modesty to help out Klal Yisrael. Quote, every Nister, everyone who is hidden among us, is obligated to reveal himself. Chaim Lozer turned around and faced the Chazon Ish. The spotlight is on him. The Chafetz Chaim looks at the Chazon Ish. And Chaim Lozer says to the Chazon Ish, if these words are not referring to you, who are they referring to? That was a changing point in his life. He knew at this point he could no longer remain anonymous. Well, he could remain anonymous, but he had to get involved and work for the Klal, for the rest of the Jewish people. But he remained within the veil of anonymity. Chazon Ish said that Klal Yisrael had the litmus test is that we know how to find our Gedolim. I don't think there's anyone in this room who was zocher to see as Moshe Feinstein as I was. By definition, I guess it means. But Moshe was this tall. How do we find this diminutive giant? That's exactly what the Chazon Ish said. We have a... He wasn't saying that wasn't a Moshe. It's a litmus test. Klal Yisrael knows how to find its Gedolim. And Kol Shekein, the Gadol said, and the Chazon Ish said, the greatest Musser is to read the biographies of Gedolim. But if he says the greatest Musser to read biographies, is how much more the Gadol speaks to you. And the Chafetz Chaim said to him, you can no longer be a mystery. You can't remain hidden. And Chaim Lozer looked at him and said, if this is not referring to you, who's he referring to? That was a statement from a Gadol. Chazon Ish always maintained that it was a critical mitzvah to settle in the land of Israel. He said all the Rishonim held so. We know that Chafetz Chaim desired to move to Eretz Yisrael. Chafetz Chaim already had a house arranged for himself in Petach Tikva, but the poll said that you can't leave unless you have a passport. He said, how do I get a passport? Bring your birth certificate. He said, when I was born, they didn't give birth certificates to Jews. He said, okay, so bring us two witnesses who were present at your bris. Chafetz Chaim is now deep in his 80s. Bring us to the people of the age, a majority who could testify they were there present when you were at your bliss. So even when they wanted to help, they ignored it. So he wasn't able to leave. So the Chazanish, that every Jew has to want the desire to go to Eretz Yisrael. And we see already at this point that he was agitating to leave, building he had not decided where he wanted to live. The one place clearly he did not want to live was Yerushalayim. The reason is unbeknownst to us, he hardly ever made it to Yerushalayim. His mother came to live with him, and then she left Bnei Brak, where Chazon Ish lived, and then traveled to her eldest son, Rav Meir, in Yerushalayim. When she passed away, the Chazon Ish came to Yerushalayim. And then he came a second time as well. And that was it. Now why? I just said we don't know. I can propose a theory, but this has got your interest. Because it's like so obvious, he must go to Yerushalayim. But I think the Chazon Ish is more obvious what he had to do. His mission was to create a bastion of Torah in Bnei Brak. And his mission was not to get involved in the whole Tumul and Yerushalayim and the Badats and all that. That he didn't want to be involved in. He wanted to be a Torah Sidur. He stepped onto the dock in the summer of 1933 in Eretz Yisrael. As they're pulling into they used to go from the mothership to the baby ship, which they pull in. He wasn't yet on terra firma. His first question was about Hilchos Trumas HaMaaseres. And he didn't know where he was going to sleep that night, not him or his wife. He was asking Shabbos about Megeya to Bineyar, the mitzvah that flew as far as. He went to Tel Aviv, and he was appalled by the situation where the Jews were not basically religious at all. And he saw house after house without a mezuzah. And he met a fellow named Yaakov Halperin, the father of Optika Halperin, the optometry shop throughout Israel. And this fellow was a wealthy businessman from Vienna. Chazon Ish said he was a very successful businessman, successful because he never missed a mitzvah. He always knew how to invest. So we have to do something about this. So Halperin gave him the money, and with that money commissioned the writing of 2,000 mezuzos. He didn't have them written there, so he didn't know his way around there, so he just come. He had them written in Lithuania, and then the Chazon Ish, went around with Halperin, and they fixed the mezuzos on the doors. No sooner had he arrived, and Rabbi Stieglitz, who was the Rosh Shiva of the Nevadic Yeshiva, a very small yeshiva in Bnei Brak. Bnei Brak, you must understand, was simply a patch of arid sand. That's all it was. The story of Bnei Brak, which is very interesting, but it's a story in and of itself, which is too much. How long are we going? More? Very briefly, the story of Bnei Brak. Did I ever tell you this? I think I did, actually. This year? Years ago. So who remembers it? Anyways, to make a long story long, actually I'm going to make it extremely short. It was just a plot of arid patch of land. It was malaria infested. There was no sweet water. And this fellow, who's a great visionary, Gershon Korn, came here and brought some Hasidim from Poland to establish a yeshiva there. And then the Panovich Rav came to Bnei Brak. And all it was is, as I described it, just sand. He saw him nestling as a Chomeini and said, he'll be a yeshiva. And he'll be a kailo. He'll be another yeshiva. And he'll be another yeshiva. And Nebuchadnezzar, the man's dreaming. Demented. He left behind him his wife that was butchered. His children that were murdered. 1,000 Talmidim annihilated. His essay on Shach, 6 carton, his magnum opus destroyed. All those buildings devastated. Nebuchadnezzar said, yes, I'm dreaming, but my eyes are open. And that great visionary built. That was the point of the Rebbe. Such unbelievable vision. Indeed, when he was able to get Rav Dessler, the Panovich Rebbe is the greatest headhunter in the history of the Jewish people. It is the privilege of the Rosh Yeshiva to hire his children, if they're qualified. When your sons will go to Parish Raga, every Rosh Yeshiva's, every teacher's name will either be David, or that'll be the name, you know, that's the privilege of the Rosh Yeshiva. Said the Panovich Rav that the boon of the Panovich Yeshiva was, is that he had no children. So David was able to hire the most stellar staff, the Shmuel Rozovsky, the Shach, the David Pavarsky, the Zero Pavarsky, Rav Chaim Friedlander, Rav Yisrael Bamberger, Hatzfeld Levenstein, and Rav Dessler. In Gateshead, they were afforded, how do you take away from us Rav Dessler? The Panovich Rav said that Rav Dessler is the Chaim Brisker of Agarata. He was able to take Agarata, which was absolutely not learned by anyone, and due to it, Rav Chaim Brisker did Talmudus in the Gemara. And there's 400 Bachrim waiting to hear from Rav Dessler. In Rav Dessler's lifetime, there's never more than 200 Talmudim in the Panovich Yeshiva. That's going to say something so apparently not true. It's not because he lied. The Panovich Rav saw the future in the present. He had that remarkable set of vision to see the future in the present. When the Panovich Yeshiva was being constructed in Bnei Brak, he would say, cup his ear and say, can you hear it? Can you hear it? He heard construction. Fine. But he heard Bnei Torah learning Torah. He heard it in the future in the present. And they called it the city of Bnei Brak, they called it the city of the Chazon Ish, and the city of the Ish HaChazon. See, the Chazon Ish, the man of vision, that was the Panovich Rav. When he was a little boy, his mother took him to Königsberg to have his eyes diagnosed by a specialist. And the eye doctor said that he has one eye which is far-sighted, one eye which is short-sighted. This is very beneficial, because one eye will always be resting. That, thus saith the doctor. But the Jews understood that a great moniker and harbinger of the future. One eye was set on the future, one eye was set on the present. He had that remarkable vision. So he's going to set up shop in Bnei Brak, and then when he arrives in Tel Aviv, this Shtigitzel, Rosh Hashiva Nevardik, goes to the Chazon Ish, says, I want you to be the Rosh Hashiva of my Yeshiva. He said, no, I didn't come to Israel to be Rosh Hashiva, I just want to learn and write my Sfarim. He said, you have to come. He said, all right, after Tisha B'Av, come and take a look. In classic Chazon Ish style, on a Torah day, Chazon Ish and his Rebbetzin take a bus, it's close to the camp, but like, there's no public transportation. And then they, on a Torah day, they walk and walk and walk and walk and walk, they come to the Nevardik Yeshiva, the top of the hill. They put out from two chairs and they look out and they see the Mediterranean to the west, Petach Tikva, the orchards of Petach Tikva to the northeast, the hills of the Lakan to the southwest. And they gaze at it for a while, both the Chazon Ish and his Rebbetzin. They're lost in their thoughts. They get up and they head back to Tel Aviv, where they have a lot of packing to do. And they decide they're going to turn this arid town into a bastion of Torah. He is an apartment without even running water, the Gadol Hador. Until a fellow from Chicago, Baruch Myers, is appalled that the Chazon Ish is living without, in a very primitive apartment, and he offers to build the Chazon Ish a house. There's no way the Chazon Ish is going to allow anyone to build him a house. As a matter of fact, when he arrived in the Bnei Brak, Gershnikorn, the one who founded Bnei Brak, said to Kenat, he saw the plain clothing, let me, do me a chesed, please do me a chesed, allow me to knit. I have tailored for you a satin frock. He said, I never wore a satin frock, and I never will wear a satin frock. So then let me make something of much cheaper quality, just at least on Shabbos you wear something a little nicer. He said, I'm still wearing the frock that was made for my wedding, and I need nothing more than that. The ultimate of simplicity. So, this Baruch Meyer from Chicago is a poor Chazon Ish living in it. That's not going to work, making him a house. So he consulted the Chazon Ish's relatives, and he had a new plan. He said, I'm building a house for myself. Can you do me a favor and move into the house? The Gemara says that a house shouldn't be left alone. It's good for the house to have people inside it. He said, okay, the Chazon Ish insisted on paying rent and paying all the taxes, and they negotiated, and somehow he paid a nominal amount of money to live in this house. And into that house later on, now the Chazon Ish decided that once he's living there as well, he wanted his beloved brother-in-law to join him. His brother-in-law was... Can you give me multiple choice? Is that correct? What happened was with that shidduch is that one day the Chazon Ish came across a sefer that was written by the stifler. It was written anonymously. Overwhelmed by its brilliance, its erudition, its depth, he assumed that Senior Rashid must have authored this. He said, no! The one who wrote the sefer is a bachar. I said, a bachar? He said, pipe it for my sister. It's unbelievable. He recently learned the Rambam, pipe it for my sister. Doesn't know what he looks like, doesn't know anything about him, pipe it for my sister. So he summons the stifler who is learning in the Ukrainian Novartis to come date the Chazon Ish's sister in Vilna. Now the stifler had a schedule. He would learn for 20 hours and then sleep for 4 hours. That was the schedule. But now he had to go on this long grueling trek to go all the way from Ukraine to Lithuania. He just had to go two cycles in a row. And he'd sleep on the train. He gets on the train, he sits down, and this is a mega major hummer on steroids. He's afraid that the padding on the seat may be shotgun. Now, I don't know if you've ever been to Ukraine. I can't imagine then that the padding was anything, you know, if it would come up and cover over you and warm you, perhaps. But the answer is sure, probably no. It has to be something which warms you or clothes you. But to sit on it, that's quite a major chumra. And yet, he's afraid to sit down. So he arrives in Vilna. He knocks on the door of his date. When she opens the door, she nearly slams it in his face. Here's a man who looks much more like an uncle than somebody's come to court her. He's got a beard. In Vilna, the big city slickers were clean-shaven. He's got a long coat. In Vilna, the big city slickers wore short jackets. He's got muddy boots. In Vilna, they wore shoes that were polished. And if that wasn't bad enough, on the date, he fell asleep. So she told her brother, forget it. What do you mean forget it? I saw the way he lives at Rambam. Perfect. Forget it. What do you mean forget it? It's perfect. Forget it. What do you forget it? He's got a long coat. External. Doesn't matter. He's got muddy boots. External. Doesn't matter. He's got a beard. External. Doesn't matter. He fell asleep. I better find out why. And when he found out why, he said, now I know it's perfect. And you say they live happily ever after. So this type that was totally dependent, totally subdued to whatever the Chazon Ish said. He once phrased it, whatever the Chazon Ish didn't say is mutter is usser. So said this type. So the type is Rosh Yeshiva, the Pinsk Yeshiva, the largest Yeshiva of learning of the Sephardic Yeshivas in the Ukraine. The Chazon Ish wishes him to join him. He sends him letter after letter. The chutzpah of the students, they don't want to lose their beloved Rosh Yeshiva. They intercept all the letters and they never deliver them. Chazon doesn't send his writing letters to his brother-in-law, no response. So the fellow in visiting Yisrael from Europe, he says, you do me a favor, and you go back to Europe, I want you to tell the cipher I want to see him. He goes to the cipher on Purim to bring him Shalach Manis and to deliver the message. The cipher is in the middle of his Purim Suda. He tells him, the Chazon Ish would like to see you. The first thing the cipher did was he benched. The second thing he did was he got up, he took his family and went to the port. He didn't make a yard sale, didn't put anything in Janglow, he just went straight to the port and left right to show. The Chazon said to come, he came. So he came to Yeshiva of the Navardic Yeshiva. It was not an especially accomplished Yeshiva. The students that he had here were far more learned than the ones he had in Like that was actually a blessing in disguise. Because all the times that he had in this yeshiva where he didn't have a lot of interaction with the students, gave him time to write his classic Kehilos Yaakov, his essay on Shas, which is core curriculum of every yeshiva person. If you go to any Avrech's house, you'll see a Shas, a Rambam, a Nikos Kedolos, a Stereo, and a Kehilos Yaakov. That's in his house. And a picture of his mother-in-law. The dark. Mm-hmm. Isn't that what he did if you miss your mother-in-law? Throw it up in fire again? So the Stifler now, the Shiva was doing never doing well financially, didn't have the greatest Talmidim, and then they couldn't make ends meet and the Shiva closed. The Stifler moved out under the stars. I only have a privilege. The custom was in those days that the Shiva would live in the Shiva building. My only privilege for living in here is that I'm the Rosh Yeshiva, but if there's no Yeshiva, I can't live here, I have no right to be here. He moved out on the stars. He wasn't worried about, you know, when he wasn't going to stay in the building, he didn't have permission, he felt he had no permission to be there. So the Chazon Ish took him into his own house, and they put a bookcase down the middle, and it was Chazon Ish and his Rebbetzin, and they were not blessed with children, and the Stifler and his Rebbetzin and their children. And this is how the Chazon Ish groomed the Stifler to not... You can't groom someone to be a gadol ador, but you certainly groom him to be the man of gadol. And that's what the Stifler learned, what was going to be necessary for him to continue the path of the Chazon Ish. In 1933, Chasnish is not, I stressed already several times, he was very much into anonymity. In 1933, on Rosh Hashanah, Rabbi Shtigitzel, the Rashiva of Navardik, asked the Chasnish to speak. He wants you to speak. No. He needs you to speak. No. He's pleading, cajoling, wheedling, finds it, okay. But not in the basement. We're going to the side room. Word gets out, Chasnish, his first public address. Everyone goes into the side room. The people are hanging from the ceiling. And this is what he says. Mishnah Perkei Avos Perek Vav. Amar Rabbi Yosi ben Kisma. Tam Achas Hayisim Mishalech Baderech. Skip a little bit. Amar Li Rabbi. V'tamach Hashatadu Imanu Bim Kameinu. V'n'etein l'cha Elef Alaf M'dinarei Chizaha V'avanim Tavos V'agaliyos. We want you, Rabbi, to live with us. We'll give you all the gold and jewels and rubies in the world. And he responded, Amarti lo imata nosin li kol kes v'zav v'avani tabosh u'magolia sheba oylem eni da elba makam teira kinkasu v'sefer tachwe v'hilem give me all the golden jewels in the world and we'll only live in makam teira. His first public address, all he said was a Mishnah, and he said no, and he said it again, and that was it. But he made his point. He'd come here because he wanted to establish a town. Now, the idea of Bnei Brak was not to establish a city with just a Jewish flavor. And you say Shabbat Shalom, and you have flags, and you have Makaviyah. The idea was to establish a Shiva that would be Mahadir Balacha. Not Kurz, but to be Machmir, to have Chumr Balacha, and be Mahadir Balacha. Now, probably Machmir Balacha means, for example, the Gemara Masechet Daf Gimel, to speak for Lashon Nekiyah, to speak in a refined way. Throughout all of Israel, the hospital is referred to as a Beit Cholim. And Bnei Brak is referred to as Beit Refuah, Lashon Nekiyah. And there are more children born in the Beit Refuah in Bnei Brak in one day than born in Tel Shomer the entire week. But because it's Bnei Brak, the boys and girls are born separately. That's a joke. That was one public address. His only other public address happened was the water pump that served the Bnei Brak was rather old-fashioned. And one fine night it broke down, and when the Chasnish learned of this, he got up in the main shul in Bnei Brak and he announced, you may not use water. And you may not wash your hands for bread. Because it would be nena from Malacha, because they sent people to repair their electrical pump on Shabbos. It would be nena from Malacha done by a Jew. And if someone is a chayla mesukun, they have to consult a rav. But you may not use water. You have to wrap your hands and eat bread that way. But you can't use water for anything. And then he sat down. That was the second and only other public address. Two other affairs that he got involved in Bnei Brak was the electric company also had it would have shorts and shabbos and they'd send Jews to repair it. So he said the best thing would be if you had non-Jews working, but then Israel felt it was not security-wise to have Arabs working in security teams and in electricity teams. And that's why in Bnei Brak, to this very day, Chasnish said you don't rely on electricity on Shabbos, and you have to have your own generator. Or use gas lanterns. Not to use electricity that could be turned on in Shabbos if it breaks down. And the third controversy was, in those times it was very customary, it was an agrarian society, people would milk on Shabbos, they'd milk the cows, and you're not allowed to derive benefits from milk that's milked on Shabbos. And he was back to the Chaim Ezer. And you couldn't get the farmers to change their custom. He said, we have to milk the cow, the pain is too great. So you can milk it, but the milk has to go into the ground. You can't use this milk. And he would reason with people and said, I'll pay you for all the milk that you lose on Shabbos. He still didn't want to do it. So he said, then bring in non-Jews. Let them milk the cows. He said, we're not going to bring non-Jews into our farm. Then the Chasnish saw reason didn't help anymore. So he made a proclamation that you have to understand that we have to keep Shabbos. It's not negotiable. This is our inheritance. And everyone who's not going to do it will pay the consequences. And all of a sudden, this is the Chasnish man business. He's taking off the big gloves. And then from that day on, there's no more people milking the cows on Shabbos and putting the milk into buckets. And that changed everything. To conclude, because with the Chasnish coming to Bnei Brak, now all of a sudden this town Nick Vell and some commentators and shucked him, and he made it a part of the Metropolis.
Is that up in Graham in the 70s?
Okay. What happened was, with the nation state of Israel, Ben Gurion was very pragmatic. He was convinced, as were others, that instead of arguing with the religious, and even though they're a small minority, throw them a bone. They are fossilized, antiquated, and in 20 years at most they'll be gone. So give a concession here or two, or three, give a concession, then afterwards you don't have to worry about a thing. So if they ask you today who's the God of Ladur, you may give me one answer, you may give me a different answer. In those days, everyone knew, even Ben-Gurion understood, that the God of Ladur was the Chazon Ish. So Mr., I don't really like to figure out his name in this letter, but Mr. B.G., went to that humble house in Bnei Brak to see the Chazon Ish. And there's many stories that came out of that meeting. Even people wrote Midrashim about that meeting. At the end of the meeting, the Prime Minister, he wasn't yet the Prime Minister, he had his agency still at that time, he asked Chazon Ish, who's going to come out first in the end? Do you think you're right, you think we're right, and what do you think, who's going to come out first in the end? So the Chazon Ish, it's a Beferish Gemara. The Gemara says, in Derech Mavo Charon, where it's a very narrow passageway, you have two animals coming in two different directions. Which animal has the right of passage? Which one goes first? And the answer is, whichever animal is laden. If you have a donkey and a camel, and a donkey has all these things on its back, he has the right of way to go first before the camel. Said the Chazon Ish, we are laden with mitzvot, and we're going to come out first. And supposedly, Mr. B.G. Was very impressed by that answer. Chazon Ish said to a gadol, you have to pick your fights. You can't argue about everything. And I'll give you an example to prove this in a moment. So he was particular that in Bnei Brak, there shouldn't be movie theaters, and to this day there aren't. There shouldn't be restaurants which have seats. You want them to come and hang out. To this day there aren't. And I don't know if I don't remember the third one. Whatever the third, there's a third one as well. But what he said, you have to pick a fight. You can't fight about everything. My proof is, I don't want to speak poorly, but the Badatzim Yerushalayim, every day, if you look on the world, there's another thing that's forbidden. And no one takes them seriously. Because if you ask you everything, you can't listen. Right? Yeshiva, who has wisdom, will tell you you can't have a video in your MP. Right? That's a smart yeshiva. But if they say everything's forbidden, you're not going to listen. Lastly, a young girl, a kala, a girl just before her wedding had a dental appointment, and in a fluky, freaky accident, the dental bit, the drill, fell off, and she swallowed it. Having a foreign object in the body meant she's going to have to have an operation. Clearly, she's not going to get married on time. Chotan were very upset, but what could they do? And everyone would always go to Chazon Ish before an operation. And the father, kala, said, he told what happened, and now we want to have an operation to go well, and now before we can have the wedding, it's like that. Chazon Ish said, you know, the wedding will be, it'll be on time. You don't have to worry. He came for a blessing, not to argue with Chazon Ish. Chazon Ish said, don't worry, it'll pass. And sure enough, that night, it came out a different end, and they were so excited. Now they have the wedding, and it's appropriate time, they don't have to cancel anything, call the invitations to cater it. And it was B'Shatah, we don't want to cancel a date when we make a, after we make a date. And they came to Chazon Ish so excited, and he says, how did you know? He said, all I know, when I was a little child, whenever he had a problem, my mother used to say, I'll say first in Yiddish, then in Hebrew, and then in English, but in English it doesn't work. This is the chasna better of the game. And the chatanazi arvoi. Until the wedding, it will pass. Meaning, your problems will pass by the time you get married. Don't worry about it. So the story is a remarkable story. In other words, who knows what he did that night? How much he stayed up and davening and learning and aroused all these things in Shemayim? He passed it off as a joke. That was classic Chazon Ish. Always doing things anonymously on behalf of his people. Zichro Baruch. Yes.
That is the way to say Chazon Ish advising to use
the Chazon Ish wrote an illustration how to do brain surgery. And the brain is very complex part of the body. He wasn't studying anatomy. And apparently it was flawless what he suggested. I never heard anyone say that the story did something inappropriate about that story. He knew exactly what to do. How to enter the brain, where to enter the brain. And we have his illustration of the brain.